Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's private equity practice. Joining me today is Rohan Chaudhary, Executive Director at Morgan Stanley Capital Partners, and Corinne Spears, Principal at Achieve Partners. Today, we're talking about managing the high cost of capital, which deals and value creation methods Rohan and Corinne believe will drive PE activity this year, and how Morgan Stanley and Achieve Partners have approached the talent challenges that new technology has introduced. Just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with that out of the way, Rohan, we'll start with you as a executive director at Morgan Stanley Capital Partners. Perhaps you can tell our listeners a bit about yourself, your firm, and your team's investment strategy.
Of course. Thank you for having us here today. Looking forward to the conversation. Just to start, maybe a little bit about our business and then some context on my role. Morgan Stanley Cap Partners is a U.S. mid-market buyout platform with $3 billion in AUM and part of Morgan Stanley Investment Management's broader $50 billion private credit and equity platform. At Cap Partners, our philosophy is all about investing to accelerate growth. We focus on services businesses, specifically in business and consumer, industrial, and healthcare, with very targeted subsectors. Fundamentally, we believe that alpha exists in the middle market. And so our approach is about seeking to leverage the scale and expertise from Morgan Stanley, bringing the operational expertise to support our portfolio companies. And that's where I spend time. I'm an operating executive on our team, and I'm focused on leading value creation, which starts as early as diligence and goes right through the life cycle of ownership. Most of that is partnering with management to drive not 20 or 10 different initiatives, but really 4 or 5 of the most needle-moving initiatives to drive value creation. I'm heading into my third year with Cap Partners after over a decade in management consulting and spend most of my time in consumer and healthcare investments.
Corinne, same question to you. As a principal at Achieve Partners, can you share a bit about yourself, your firm, and your investment strategies?
Thanks, Todd. Achieve Partners is a lower middle market private equity firm based here in New York City with a core focus on closing the skills gap in the US. We have two main strategies. One is EdTech, where we buy and grow education technology companies selling into higher education and K-12 institutions. The second is our workforce strategy, where we invest in sectors of the economy with the skills. In this strategy, we are acquiring services companies. That includes business services, healthcare services, and then we're actually building out a training or apprenticeship program to create this proprietary talent engine. So we're flipping the script a little bit. Instead of talent being a growth and profitability hindrance, it comes as a competitive advantage where we see stronger growth at higher gross margins. Our portfolio today includes partners from Salesforce ecosystem, Workday, Epic ecosystems. We also have a cybersecurity company, behavioral health and school nursing staffing company, and also touch ServiceNow, Snowflake, and a couple of other ecosystems and technologies. We're very careful and thoughtful about who we partner with and invest in. We see this as a long-term partnership and are very disciplined, often following companies for several years before making an investment. Across both funds, the number one thing we look for is a strong management team. Most of the time, we're backing founder-led businesses, but not always. And in all of our investments, we're taking majority ownership. Check sizes are usually ranging from 15 to 20 million from our fund. But we have a great LP base that's always open to co-investment opportunities. So we're able to increase the check sizes as needed, up to usually about 50 million. As for me, I've been with Achieve for almost 6 years now, and I spend most of my time on the workforce side. But as a smaller firm, there are often opportunities for folks to get involved across both strategies.
Well, it's awesome to have you with us as well, Corinne. And I think the background on both of your firms will be helpful as we jump into the topic. So most of our recent episodes have included some heavy discussion around the cost of capital. As we all know, currently it's the highest it's been since the great financial crisis. So knowing that, I thought our listeners would appreciate some insight around how you both have been managing the current economic landscape. Rohan, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, of course. I'd say this is a topic we talk about every week. I'd contextualize my answer in maybe three parts. First, we've always had a conservative approach to debt financing. It's very important to us as a firm that our investments have flexibility right out of the gate to go after both organic and inorganic initiatives. I'd also say one of the core tenets of our philosophy is investing in businesses that have attractive cash flow dynamics, so typically low CapEx and favorable working capital, which in our experience generally results in sustainable financing needs. The second thing is that this moment, I think, is all about partnership between us, the financing ecosystem, and our management teams. On our part, it's about maintaining strong relationships with lenders and keeping a pulse on credit markets, which often allows us to drive value in the moment. With our management teams, we stay very close to cash flow, forecasting monthly and in some cases even weekly to make sure that excess capital is always being deployed to the most accretive initiatives. Sometimes that's M&A, sometimes that's innovation. Last, I'd say we're always looking ahead, and we'll talk a little more about it, but that really means scenario planning for both good and difficult economic cycles. That helps us avoid surprises because the economic landscape around us is constantly evolving. Take the last couple of weeks. March inflation data has continued to exceed expectations. And if you compare that to the tenor, it's very different from back in January. People started the year expecting multiple rate cuts, and that enthusiasm started to vanish. I think the environment around us can change very rapidly, and so being prepared is incredibly important.
You're certainly not my only PE contact that is doing weekly cash flows during these challenging times. So I appreciate all that insight. So Corinne, turning to you, in what ways are you adapting your investment strategies, really, if at all, to cope with the challenges posed by the high cost of capital?
Private equity often has relied on high leverage to drive returns. The current cost of capital has really challenged a lot of these funds to rethink their playbooks. For Achieve, and it sounds quite similar to the approach that Rohan outlined, we've been quite conservative with the leverage historically and have pursued strong results through growth, multiple expansion, and operational discipline. We're typically capping leverage at the 3, maybe 3.5 times EBITDA. Sometimes we're pegging this to ARR where applicable. So the high interest rates have not dramatically changed our approach to deploying capital and investing, but it has created us to focus more closely on a couple of things. First, we are adding a larger buffer, cash buffer, to the balance sheet at close. And while this is a more expensive tactic than it's been historically, we often hold the cash in high interest accruing accounts. So the spread is not huge, but it still gives our management teams breathing room to both service the debt and pursue innovation and other growth initiatives. Secondly, we emphasize operational discipline earlier in the hold period. Given the challenges posed by the increasing cost of labor and broader inflationary pressures, organizational change is harder, but more important than ever. And the quicker you can get visibility into the organization and drive this change and discipline, the more flexibility we have when pursuing some of these new growth initiatives. And lastly, finding really great debt partners has never been more important. We spend a lot of time upfront vetting prospective lenders and trying to understand how they respond to tough circumstances. We're very fortunate to have worked with some amazing lenders who recognize the complexities of today's environment and have demonstrated great support throughout. But it's not luck. It's really about spending and investing the time up front to pick the right partners here.
Corinne, I'm going to stay with you as a follow-up. I guess, are you able to share any innovative financing structures or techniques your firm is employing to mitigate the impact of the high cost of capital?
Sure. One structure we often employ is leveraging two tranches of debt. The first tranche typically involves a more traditional senior bank loan with a rate closer to prime, you know, plus maybe 50 to 100 basis points. The second tranche is often secured from an SBIC lender, which comes with a higher interest rate, typically ranging from maybe 11, 12% in a low interest environment to mid-teens today. And each tranche has its own advantages and disadvantages. But what we love about this approach is the flexibility that it gives us. Not only does it provide us with a diversified funding base, but it also enables us to optimize our blended cost of capital across various scenarios, particularly in the high interest environment that we're in today.
Appreciate that. Rohan, I'm going to kind of broadly this same topic, different angle. So we understand that your role is focused on driving operational improvement. So from what you've seen, how are companies adapting to this environment? And perhaps you can share any best practices on what is working well across your portfolio.
Of course. And maybe I can hit a little bit of what Corinne was talking about and then talk about portfolio companies. I'd say this has been a huge priority for us, and we've been very focused on it. I think if you wind the clocks back a little bit, as inflation started to rise and rates along with it, we took some early measures to protect our portfolio companies. And early in the rising cycle, we executed certain interest rate hedges that allowed those portfolio companies to maintain favorable spreads to the current SOFR. I'd say at the time, we debated it quite a lot. And in hindsight, it was a pretty good decision. Across the rest of our portfolio, and Corinne hit some of this, we've used a number of different things based on the time and context. In some cases, that means shifting a portion of interest payments from cash pay to PIK. At times, it could be removing credit spread adjustments or even just changing the mix of senior and junior to help maintain acquisition capacity. I think I said this earlier, but having a close partnership with the financing ecosystem is crucial, and we feel very lucky to have great relationships given our history. In portfolio companies, I'd say every one of our portcos employs a very rigorous budgeting and capital allocation process. And not surprisingly, in times like this, that's required closer than ever partnership. Every investment is tied to ROI, and progress to that is monitored very closely. I'd say we're often revisiting expectations, 90, 60, sometimes even 30 days in to make sure we're trending right and adjusting as we learn. Outside of all of those things, we are really just focused on driving organic growth and deploying our playbook. In times like these, I'd say driving efficiencies can be very valuable. Sometimes that's productivity through, you know, centralization and training, or procurement efficiencies from leveraging scale and negotiations.
Let's pivot a bit to deal activity. So while there is still macroeconomic uncertainty, credit markets have been in an optimistic mood. We're starting to see some firms and portcos take advantage to make incremental improvements to their valuations. So for the remainder of 2024, I'm curious, which types of deals do you think will drive the most PE activity? And perhaps you could touch on what subsectors are you most focused on? Maybe Corinne, we'll start with you on this one.
Sure. Deal value has fallen about 65-70% since its peak in 2021, and deal volume has dropped 35%. And when you layer in the heightened levels of fundraising that occurred in 2021 and 2022, there is a huge demand to deploy capital, and particularly for new platforms. So I would say we're certainly cautiously optimistic about what this year is going to hold. Last year, we kept hearing about a big wave of deals that will hit in Q1. And while our team is certainly busy and activity has definitely picked up, I wouldn't say it was a huge wave that we were promised, but it's absolutely picking up. For Achieve specifically, we are seeking 1 to 2 additional services platforms in areas that struggle with the talent shortage. Top of mind ecosystems include SAP, ServiceNow, data, and several pockets in healthcare, including nursing and behavioral health. We are looking at dozens of ecosystems beyond that. And we're still looking to make tuck-in acquisitions for our portfolio companies. We were quite active here in 2022 and 2023, but we have continued appetite here. And more broadly, I'm just very excited to see what the second half of this year has in store for everyone.
Yeah, agreed. I know our sell-side diligence team has been very busy over the last couple months with working on deals that are coming to the market in the coming weeks. So we remain optimistic as well. So Rohan, what are you currently seeing on the value creation front, especially as people are starting to feel more optimistic?
You know, I agree with everything Corinne said, and maybe I'll take a broad-based view on this.
Yeah.
I think value creation in 2024 is going to be all about the end user. Let's take the average consumer. It's been over 2 years of decades high inflation, peak interest rates, rising mortgages, complicated labor markets, and that's on the back of COVID. I think the average consumer is probably just exhausted. And so that means it's really important, at least how we think about it, is driving value creation in a way that ultimately drives incremental benefit back to the consumer. And so for any consumer-facing portfolio, that means ways to find and improve the buying experience, improving the fundamental quality of services being offered, or streamlining services to make it easy, efficient, and cost-effective back to the consumer. I'd say those are the conversations we're having every week from a value creation standpoint and the kinds of initiatives we're resourcing. And taking a step back, I think that opportunity can be really exciting, particularly for operationally oriented investors who can roll up their sleeves and drive value.
All right. Well, I appreciate that, Rohan. Technological innovation has continued to fuel and disrupt service companies, a focus for both of your firms. Can you share how some of these emerging technologies are challenging the talent and labor dynamics for your portfolio companies? Rohan, let's start with you on this one.
So I thought I would start this segment with a fun but completely unsurprising fact. From 2022 to 2023, one of the biggest increases in a category of Google searches was, no surprises, ChatGPT. And I think without a doubt, generative AI last year took center stage for everyone. And us included, it was a reminder of just how powerful and disruptive these technologies can be. Given our subsector priorities, we believe these technologies are a tailwind and an opportunity to capitalize on driving efficiencies. I'd say this was a big focus of mine last year as we evaluated cross-portfolio opportunities while looking across Morgan Stanley to see what kind of best practices we could leverage given their skill and investment. There were a couple of very big learnings as we went through this discovery process. One of many is that in almost every instance in every company, there are lots of use cases to consider, but it was always more important to separate out what we thought was a near-term quick win from those initiatives that were maybe more transformative. Quick wins would be things that our teams could augment their day-to-day with better tools that already exist, and a lot of our teams have made great strides in adopting that. Transformative initiatives, I think, are more compelling, but need to be well-resourced, and even more importantly, trialed and piloted first. We have some exciting application of GenAI's summarization and extraction capabilities in consideration, and they are fundamentally improving operations. I think there's huge potential here. But with all things like this, it's going to take some time to see the impact. For a lot of mid-market companies, it can take even time to find the right third party or talent to hire, as these capabilities don't necessarily exist. And so that's why we believe it's really important to prioritize the few bets that matter and resource those effectively. And that's been our mindset so far.
Sure, sure. Well, BDO Digital is doing a ton of work with our PE clients at the fund and portco level. And it's interesting how different firms are adapting on different timelines, but seems like it's here to stay. So I appreciate that. Over to you, Corinne. What have you been seeing on the labor and tech front? Knowing your role is very talent focused, maybe you can share how your portcos have been approaching some of the more recent hurdles that have popped up.
Absolutely. This is what we look at all day, every day. So I love answering this question. The current landscape of inflation and escalating labor costs is placing immense pressure on companies, especially within the services and staffing sectors, which are areas I special in. When you layer in some of the dynamics that Rohan already highlighted, a lot of these companies are really getting squeezed on so many areas, and they're struggling to navigate what the implications of AI are going to be on their workforce and can be hesitant to invest in their workforce. Many of these organizations have turned to offshore or nearshore talent as a solution. However, the surge in demand has made even this talent pool increasingly difficult to recruit and retain. And furthermore, a lot of industries and customers from the public sector, financial services, healthcare often face regulatory constraints that limit their ability to leverage offshore talent. So all of these constraints are putting pressure on companies' growth and margin profiles. And on the other side of the talent equation, you have a growing population of capable young adults struggling to find suitable employment opportunities. The most recent Burning Glass and Strata workforce report was released just a few months ago and found that over 50% of recent graduates are underemployed a year after completing their degree. And even more alarmingly, research shows that about half of those individuals will remain underemployed even after a decade. So this dichotomy presents as a really significant challenge. Employers are grappling with the shortage of skilled talent, which is exacerbated by a lot of the changing skill landscape. And young adults are now seeking employment, but often they're lacking the necessary industry-aligned certifications. So at Achieve, our job and our mission is to help alleviate this friction. And in response, many of our portfolio companies have embraced a hire, train, deploy model. This involves recruiting recent graduates or career changers, providing them with comprehensive classroom and on-the-job training and industry-specific credentials, and then deploying them out to client engagements. We've also implemented some lighter touch models where helpful, including programs to enhance talent retention and recruit prospective employees from adjacent industries. But more broadly, we really believe that even in an environment where the workforce needs are changing so rapidly, it really matters to invest in your own workforce, and it's going to yield dividends. And so we're often pushing our own companies to prioritize this investment to overcome some of the hurdles that we're seeing.
Yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate that angle. As a father of a couple young adults, some of those stats are pretty alarming, Corinne, but good to know. So sadly, that's going to bring us to our last question of the episode. Each of your predictions for the rest of the year. We tend to call this our crystal ball question. So last year certainly was no easy feat, but as we get further into this year, we've all talked that we're seeing a feeling of cautious optimism emerging. So I will ask each of you kind of your general predictions for private equity for the remainder of the year. Rohan, why don't you kick this one off?
Yeah, happy to.
Yeah.
So 2 weeks ago, I think my answer would have been a bit different. So I'll take this at predictions that I'm sure would be outdated soon enough. We talked about it a lot today, but private equity expectations heading into this year were high. Last year, Corinne hit all the stats. Deal value was down. Exit value even more. Capital raising slowed while dry powder went up. In some ways, from just a pure, you know, year-on-year trend perspective, those characteristics looked a lot to what the post-GFC period did. But the fundamental economy is completely different. Low unemployment, high wage growth, surging public markets. And so I think a lot of that disconnect reflects just how much of a shock the pace of rising rates had on the broader PE community. So moving forward, I think the question is unsurprisingly about what happens to interest rates next and how that impacts behavior in the broader market. Even over the last couple of weeks, it feels like we're suddenly facing a scenario of rates staying higher for longer. My personal view is that we will see rate cuts this year, but likely not till the fourth quarter. I think on the flip side, if inflation doesn't slow down, particularly in things like housing and insurance, the conversation of another rate increase could become very real. I think in the end, our role is to focus on what we can control, and that is about looking ahead and planning efficiently and seeking to drive value in the way we know how and continuing to build great companies.
Well, I won't hold you to any of those predictions, but I certainly hope we don't see a rate increase, even though it's a possibility. I shudder to think. So, Corinne, what are your thoughts? Are there any other areas you want to keep a close eye on throughout 2024 and any insight into what your firm and its portcos may be focused on in the coming months?
Certainly. So, plus one to everything Rohan mentioned, I'll offer a few additional predictions and thoughts. So first, I have a lot of confidence that we'll see deal volume pick up in the second half of this year. Many companies are really eager to secure wins and return capital to their LPs. And you have many of these same players that need to deploy capital and start fundraising, especially after a slow 2023. So while I don't think the year will be everything that we were promised in 2023, I do think that we're going to start to see a big uptick in the second half of this year. Second, I believe there will be a moderation of the use of leverage at close. I think these high interest rates are here to stay, as Rohan mentioned, at least for the next quarter or two. And too many companies are just over-levered and really struggling to keep up with the service payments. And growth is really the casualty there. And so I think more funds have quite a bit of pressure to reduce this risk with new platforms that they're going out and acquiring this year. And third, I think there's going to be a widening gap between some of the top tier A-plus assets and those with a few more thorns. I think A-plus assets will probably command higher valuations than we've seen previously, while the risk will probably see a drop in valuation from the last couple of years. So it will be an interesting second half to the year for private equity, but we're certainly really excited to see what it has in store.
I'm hearing a lot of enthusiasm and optimism, Corinne. So I appreciate all that insight.
Yeah, of course.
Well, thank you both for certainly a very interesting conversation. We value our relationship with both your firms and really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to join the podcast today. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Todd.
Yeah, my pleasure. So to our listeners, thanks so much for listening. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.
Investment banking products and services within the United States are offered exclusively through BDO Capital Advisors, LLC, a separate legal entity, an affiliated company of BDO USA, LLP, a Delaware limited liability partnership and national professional services firm. For more information, visit bdocap.com. Certain services may not be available to attest clients under the rules and regulations of public accounting. BDO Capital Advisors, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC.